program, so you can ask us stuff. How cool is that? Today, we're joined by the lovely and talented Valerie Tirico. She is just full of fantastic stuff, and we're going to get to all the things that she does in just a little bit. And the lovely and talented Rebecca Friedman, and I'm Deanna Joy Lyons.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I think it's been a while since Deanna, you and I have been on the air, and it's been a great few days, and we're happy to be here. Deanna, it's real fun.
So today's topic, we're going to get a lot into, I think, birth control. We're going to talk about morality and values, all the things that we can kind of do in a secular manner. But we're going to start with a couple of emails.
Right? We are called Ask an Atheist, and we do welcome your calls at 253-584-1480. And in the meantime, we've got some folks asking us some questions. We're happy to get to your emails. You can also email us by going to askanatheist.tv, clicking on the shiny red button saying ask a question, and hey, submit your emails.
All right, so today's first email is from Kush from Germany. It says, does the rejection of Judaism and subsequently of its adherents constitute anti-Semitism? In web discussions and almost every criticism of the Bible, Judaism and its deity sooner or later leads to accusations of anti-Semitism. How does one respond to that? What do you think, Valerie?
Well, I think you have to start by remembering that Jewish people are collectively responding to the world from a position of trauma. I say that as a, you know, kind of a psychologist, and those are the ways I think. But when people have been hurt in some way, they tend to be highly sensitized to and reactive to in ways that make them kind of vigilant to prevent that from happening again. It certainly is the case that people tend to react to, for example, criticism of Israel by kind of shouting anti-Semitism, and yet, if you look at some of the criticism of Israel objectively, it very easily spills over into something that is more than just criticism of Israel. It spills over into things that are hard to call anything but anti-Semitism.
I think that it's really interesting, this sort of concept that a lot of atheists have, and approach that a lot of atheists have in terms of being able to criticize beliefs and have it not be a criticism of a person or a person's identity. And I think that for a lot of people that have an identity that's wrapped up in a cultural heritage and a religious belief system, that's very difficult to sort of understand. I'm separating these two parts of your personality. I'm separating these two parts of you as a person. And I think that your belief system is faulty. I think that there's something amiss in what you're believing in, without it having it be perceived by a believer as a personal attack. And that's something that I think is important to be aware of. It's not necessarily saying that we have to then abide by that at all times. We can say, hey, look, I'm questioning something that you believe because it's patently false, or it's patently, there's no evidence to suggest that it is true in this way. But that is not inherently a criticism of you as a person. And that's, I can see that happens sometimes on web discussions. I'm wondering whether Kush from Germany has ever had these kinds of discussions face to face, and whether he has or she has been met with something different from accusations of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And in person, discussions like this tend to be a lot more easy for everybody to interpret what the other person is saying. When you are seeing the person's body language, you have their eye contact, and you can hear their tone of voice, you know that they're not saying, oh my God, all you Jews are horrible people. That they're saying, you know, this idea is not correct, and I'm going to say that I think that idea is not correct. And when you get into those mediums of text, especially without any good sarcasm tags for the internet, it's a little hard to tell what's being said and who's being criticized and how.
The other thing is that Kush, you know, finalizes his question saying, well, how does one respond to that? We've talked a little bit about sort of the psychology behind it and sort of the social circumstances behind this kind of interaction and this phenomenon. But how should Kush sort of talk about this or respond to it? I mean, you have a few options. One is to not necessarily engage in these kinds of web discussions, but save them for face-to-face. But I think that the internet is a extremely valuable medium for this kind of discussion. So, you know, your other choice is to really stress, hey, I believe that I can distinguish between criticizing a person and criticizing your beliefs, or criticizing your, you know, or criticizing the book from whence your religious and cultural heritage comes. Speaking as someone who grew up in a very pluralistic Jewish, you know, family and background, having many different Jewish experiences from, you know, very progressive Reconstructionist to having family members who are Orthodox Hasidic, there is no small amount of criticism of the book itself within various members of the tribe, so to speak. And so that's something that, you know, sometimes is an internal discussion that internally happens amongst Jews.
I think, though, when it's coming from the outside, that people are more ready to perceive it as a personal attack. And one thing that atheists or secularists could remember about religion is that people tend to hear things more harshly than they are intended. And so you don't have to say things in the most explicit, kind of forceful way. You can put forward a pretty soft, inquiring criticism of religion, and people hear you loud and clear.
So my question would be, what if you discuss something softly or put forth a small inquiry of, I'm just asking the question, and your sort of proponent or your foil on the other side of the computer screen sort of buckles down and digs in, but you really want your point to sort of be heard and your position to be considered? Do you think that, Valerie, there's a time to then sort of push a little harder?
Well, I think that most of the time, if somebody can't hear you when you're being soft, they can't hear you when you're being loud either. But that one of the ways to deal with that is to simply use that old broken record technique. So hold your ground, kind of be clear, be true to yourself, but you don't necessarily have to escalate. You don't necessarily gain much by escalating.
Yeah, and I think it's also a valuable technique sometimes too, when you are repeating yourself over and over again. It's not always the people that you're talking to that get your point. Like if you are having a direct argument with someone else, it's the other people that are watching that argument, which is kind of why the internet is so interesting. I've learned more people or more things by watching other people argue about a topic than by actually arguing about it myself. So that's probably a good thing to remember. And when it comes to answering anti-Semitism, I think a valid point is to let people know that you realize that Jewish people are just as widely varied as any human on the planet. And they all have different ideas and different doctrines. And as Becky said, you know, criticism of the biblical the Torah and the books of the Bible are a huge part of Jewish culture. So everybody kind of joins in on that. And you can remind the person that, you know, you're doing the same thing that everybody does, is we take a view and we all have our own ideas about it. We're not lumping everybody together with stereotypes. I think we'll go to our next email. What do you guys say?
Yes. We've got Dan from Fort Myers, Florida. Dan's a 23-year-old college student. He's an atheist. And he asks about love. You know, a few weeks ago, around Valentine's Day and around in January, we had talked about love and dating and things like that. And, well, you know, Dan's asking us about whether he can find love, too, since he's noticed that, you know, a few of us have to. He says that being that my way of thinking is grounded in scientific ideas, more and more I find myself thinking of love and relationships from an oddly shallow and cold scientific manner. I worry that love is just a chemical reaction in the brain and therefore doesn't have any actual meaning and is just a product of this desire to reproduce. He really continues that his questions are, do we believe in love? What is love? And are love and lust truly separate things? Is it all just a chemical reaction in the brain? And finally, if love is a drug, does one develop a tolerance for the drug and so must move on to higher drugs, so to speak, to get the same feeling? Dan in Fort Myers, Florida, you know, saying no doubt he wants to be married and find love, but he's not completely cynical. But one thing is for sure, almost no one is truly monogamous, and it's against our nature, right? So we've got a lot of questions here from a very curious college student. What do you guys think about love? Is it a drug? Does it mean that it has no meaning if it all is just chemical reactions in our brain?
Well, of course, the obvious starting point is that it is chemical reactions in our brain. And yes, nature programmed us with those chemicals so that we would reproduce. That's the kind of really nitty-gritty answer that a lot of people worry threatens the meaning of love and the preciousness of love. And yet reality is that even though we are physical beings and we are chemical beings, our experience is something that we cherish, and it is something that gives meaning to our life. That meaning is something that we ourselves create, is what atheists think and what humanists think. And so it doesn't, the mechanism by which those experiences are created doesn't mean they're any less significant.
You know, saying that love is just a chemical reaction in the brain, as is everything. All of our experiences are mitigated through these chemical processes and these interactions between our physical world, the people around us. I mean, hunger is a chemical reaction in the brain. Our hormones are secreted that make us hungry. And does that mean that I should, you know, only eat exactly what, you know, I'm scripted to eat, you know, 7 days a week? Or does it mean that, hey, one day I can change it up and I can take a cooking class and I can do something? Does that degrade? Does the fact that hunger is a hormonal, you know, process and interaction degrade my joy of cooking? I don't think so.
I think you're right. Absolutely. And meaning especially is kind of a slippery word. You know, we can say this has meaning and that doesn't have meaning, but really meaning is only what we give the meaning of meaning to, right? You know, I find love meaningful. I find my human relationships meaningful. And those are all, you know, greatly based in chemical reactions. But it doesn't mean I have to treat them as cold chemical processes. They're things that bring me lots of warmth and happiness. And even if that warmth and happiness is in itself just a dopamine reaction, doesn't mean I can't, you know, take joy in that and take joy in giving that reaction to other people.
Yeah. Now, the final part of Dan's email, if love is a drug, does one develop a tolerance for the drug and so must move on to higher and higher drugs? It's kind of a strange way to sort of think about it. I mean, the fact is that, you know, just because something is a chemical process doesn't mean that everybody develops an addiction reaction to it. I mean, one could say, you know, we're kind of necessary to have sort of social interactions. We developed as social and tribal sort of societies, and just because it's sort of built into how we developed doesn't mean that it's necessarily a drug and we have sort of an addictive response to it necessarily. I'm sure for you know, the general population.
We'll come back to your analogy of hunger. If we got habituated to hunger and needed more and more and more and more, that would be entirely maladaptive. There are lots of ways that our bodies work chemically that are even keeled. There are also medications that have been developed by pharmaceutical companies that don't result in any kind of tolerance. Our body kind of is able to use them in a steady way and to continue to get what we need out of them.
So not all drugs or not all chemicals create an addictive response, and not all drugs create habituation where we need more and more.
That's
so
it.
Dan, go on loving.
There you go. Absolutely. Don't despair. Everything's got meaning and happiness and love in it. All right. Let's go to a break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into our topic.
Feel free to call us in at 253-584-1480. This is Ask an Atheist.
Don't believe in God? Join the club. Humanists, atheists, and freethinkers have joined the American Humanist Association since 1941 to advocate for progressive values and equality for non-theists in America. Located in Washington, D.C., the American Humanist Association lobbies Congress on humanist issues, protects the rights of atheists in the courts, and supports more than 140 local chapters. Visit us at AmericanHumanist.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter to learn how you can join the club today.
Billy, I'm a certified ghost expert.
Wow, that's so credible.
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you and to give me your lunch money.
Aw, anything for family. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
come to this year's Northwest Freethought Alliance Conference, March 30th through April 1st at Renton Technical College in Renton, Washington. Speaking at the conference is Richard Dawkins, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Oxford, author of many books including The Magic of Reality, and well-known to the atheist community as one of the Four Horsemen. Also speaking is friend of the show and author of Attack of the Theocrats, Sean Faircloth. The cast of Ask an Atheist will be making an appearance and recording an episode in front of a live audience. For more information, visit nwfreethoughtalliance.org.
Atheism TV. News, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Or rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's best source of atheist videos. Visit atheismtv.com.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
And how do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
And we're back on Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. I'm Rebecca Friedman, and with me is Deanna and Valerie Tirico. I'd like to give a little bit of a more formal introduction to Valerie. Valerie is a psychologist and writer based in Seattle, Washington. She completed her PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Iowa and her postdoctoral studies at the University of Washington. And now, Valerie, you're a writer, and as a writer, you tend to tackle the intersection between religious belief, psychology, and politics. You're also the author of Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light. You currently write for the Huffington Post, Truth Out, and exchristian.net. And you also have a Trusting Doubt YouTube channel, Life After Christianity. And a complete set of really all of your writings is available, I believe, at awaypoint.wordpress.com.
That's right. Thanks for having me today.
So we were answering some of our emails and some of our listeners, and we welcome you to call us or submit your emails at askanatheist.tv. But for now, since we've got you in the room, Valerie, we'd really love to talk a little bit about sort of what you do and some of your writings and how you're based. You know, some of the things that I've been reading on your different blogs and your projects. You have a project called wisdomcommons.org, right? Mm-hmm. And you espouse sort of this concept of all humans having a shared moral core. And this sounds very humanistic. It sounds sort of grounded in the tenets of humanism, but it also seems to make accommodations for religious believers. And do you consider yourself a humanist?
You know, there's so many labels and they mean different things to different people. I call myself a spiritual non-theist when people ask me, and the reason that I call myself that is because then people have to actually ask me, what does that mean? Ah. And I get to say, I don't have any kind of humanoid God concept, but I believe that issues of meaning and morality are at the very heart of who we are as human beings.
So how do you sort of go about stressing that value of those shared morals or how humans make their meaning in light of, you know, some of the religious trauma and abuse that some believers are subjected to? So how do you find that common ground amongst spiritual believers and spiritual non-theists? Do you find that you're able to do that?
Well, so wisdomcommons.org is one piece of what I do. Another part is the Life After Christianity work, where I'm actually creating resources for recovering fundamentalists. But the Wisdom Commons is an interactive website that is structured around 100 character virtues. And those virtues, if you look at the site, you'll see that they are things that are they are valued across wisdom traditions, whether they're secular wisdom traditions or religious wisdom traditions, things like courage or generosity or compassion, things that we all value. And I would say that the reason that we have a shared moral core is because we are because of who we are. We are social animals. We are social information specialists. We live in community with each other. And in order to be able to live in community with each other, to kind of take care of each other and to take care of ourselves, we need to have certain kinds of behaviors, certain kinds of values that promote those behaviors. So you know, children develop the same kinds of moral emotions regardless of whether they are born into religious families or not. Empathy, for example, shame. They develop through moral developmental stages at the same ages, again, regardless of which religion they're born into or regardless of whether their parents have any kind of religion at all. Those things are, I would say, they are built into us by the fact that all of us have a shared experience of needing each other, and all of us have a shared experience of experiencing things that cause us distress or pain or suffering, and things that cause us delight or joy or wonder or well-being.
I think that that's, I mean, it's beautifully stated. I was really intrigued by some of those shared virtues and shared, pieces of wisdom. But one of the things that I looked at is that sort of the top seven, or the seven most common that are mentioned by members of wisdomcommons.org, get into this sort of like top seven list. And although that may be ever changing based on sort of user input and member input, I could imagine some atheists bristling at this sort of top seven named virtues. When you sort of codify and name these virtues that maybe we observe as being all shared, but then we sort of put titles on them, I don't know, it may seem very similar to, say, a list of 10 commandments or 5 pillars or 4 noble truths. And how are these virtues distinguished from these sort of religious doctrines and religious sort of lists or how would you answer an atheist that maybe would say, hey, this is just another list, I don't need this, I rejected this from my previous religion that I was growing up with?
Well, a lot of atheists are people who have previously been religious and who have seen the ugly side of whatever religion they experienced, and even those who weren't previously religious are in cultures and in they're living in cities, they're living in countries that are predominantly religious, and so they experience the oppressiveness at times of that tries to dictate what our conscience should be. So yeah, there is a kind of reactance against anything that looks like a top-down assertion of moral authority sometimes, or a reaction against anybody insisting that there even are moral absolutes. And yet I would say that there are, and that they are baked into our bodies by our evolutionary biology, by what it takes for a human being to flourish, for us to thrive in community with each other, and the process of arriving at those values or articulating those values via, for example, wisdomcommons.org is very different from a religion in which there's a hierarchy that imposes authority on other people. Instead, the process, what's really cool about the web is that we can engage in shared processes in which our kind of where our commonalities are kind of bubbles to the surface, right? People are involved in voting and more democratic processes or conversations that are increasingly sophisticated.
So this is kind of a more organic process of arriving at some common, that common shared moral core that you talk about?
On the Wisdom Commons, there's a representation of it. For example, that when people register, they can choose to indicate the seven virtues that most matter to them, and to say why they most value those virtues. And then there's a tag cloud on the front page, and the what you see is that the virtues that have been most selected are larger than the other virtues. So just at a glance, you get a sense of where the common ground is, where the commonality is for people, at least who are using wisdomcommons.org.
Awesome. Now, you were talking about sort of response, this developed as we developed. It's part of our biology. It's part of who we are. Let's get into a little bit more of that biology part. You've been writing, Valerie, recently a lot about the topic of birth control and how reproductive control and reproductive rights sort of is handled in public discourse and more sort of currently within public policy? And sort of how do you see us as a country sort of negotiating that line between religious freedom and, by extension, the freedom that we all have not to practice any religion and sort of this public welfare? I've seen this we recently had the Blunt Amendment that was being discussed in the Senate saying, hey, people can exert their religious freedom by denying certain kind of health care coverage. The primary example is birth control coverage. So how do you see that? How do you see us as a country negotiating that line between religious freedom and public welfare?
You know, religious freedom is never absolute. The Old Testament lists dozens of transgressions that should deserve capital punishment, and they range from things like a girl not being a virgin on her wedding day, for example, to a teenager talking back to his parents, and no one would get away in our society with deciding that they were going to enact Old Testament law and then claiming religious freedom to do so. We give people limited religious freedom, but always there is this sense that there are civil rights and that there are legal rights and obligations that constrain that freedom in our society.
Yeah, we see that in a lot of things, that occasionally religious freedom does butt up against, other people's liberty. And we do have to make sure that we're not trampling on anybody's religious freedoms, but at the same time, not letting those religious ideas trample on other people's freedoms. Washington's recent marriage amendment is a good example of that. Religious people were afraid that they were going to be sued or punished or chastised for not performing same-sex marriage ceremonies. And so the way that was mitigated is they made it so that in the gay marriage amendment that nobody could suffer legally for not performing a gay marriage, but then they can't also stop gay marriage from happening in the state for everybody else.
It's a balancing act. And, the reality is that religious institutions are not interested in religious freedom. They trumpet it loudly when they want specifically the right to do something that they want to do. But, you know, think about the Catholic Church trumpeting religious freedom. How hypocritical is that after kind of the Crusades, the Inquisition? And what they're trying to do now is actually the same thing that they have always tried to do, which is to force religious homogeneity. And the reason that it's a problem for them right now is that their own members don't agree with the hierarchy about matters of religious conscience, about what God expects of them and what God's priorities are for them. In fact, there are many Catholics who see contraception as a moral and spiritual obligation, which is why the hierarchy is so intent on imposing constraints that limit access to contraception. If people didn't want it, if the employees of Catholic-affiliated institutions didn't want it, there wouldn't be any conflict.
That's fascinating and sort of very, very provocative and touchy to say, you know, even within your own ranks, your members are very much sort of against, in practice and in moral conviction, the very thing that your hierarchy is instructing them to do. Valerie, one of the really provocative things that stuck with me that you've written recently along these lines is saying that the numbers are in, and the most effective way to reduce abortion, which is also something that the Catholic Church and many Christian religious groups are decrying. You know, we have to limit the number of abortions. We have to restrict it. We have to outlaw it. The most effective way, according to your research that you've done, is to destigmatize sexual education, demythologize virginity, and invest in broad access to the most effective contraceptions available. And you go on to say in this article in that you wrote in January, so why does the religious right keep their focus on restrictive laws instead of on contraceptive access? Why do they promote person rights for zygotes in contradiction to the very essence of personhood? And why do they oppose medically accurate sex ed? Why do they pledge to defund Title X family planning? And your answer that you came up with Is because abortion isn't really what interests them. They want purity. They want righteousness. Some even want designated breeders. And even those who don't consciously promote more births are subject to the competitive strategies that were baked into the desert religions from the beginning. And that sort of quote really rounds out a lot of very provocative sort of images and realities about religion. Can you talk a little bit about this difference between personhood, the very essence of personhood, and person rights for zygotes and that kind of, along that kind of thinking? What have you been hearing, and sort of what is your reaction to that?
Let me say first of all that if people wanted to make the vast majority of abortions go away, the thing to do is to actively promote long-acting reversible contraceptives. The pill has a 1 in 12 woman failure rate. It's 1960s technology. It means that every year, 1 in 12 women on the pill in real-world use gets pregnant. Most people don't know that. With just condoms, it's 1 in 8 couples using condoms gets pregnant every year. If you have the best hormonal IUD on the market, the Mirena, that number drops to 1 in 700. With a non-hormonal IUD, it's around 1 in 500. And an implant is the same. So there's a really straightforward way to eliminate almost all of the abortions in this country, and the religious right is simply not interested in it. Coming back to this question of personhood, what they are interested in is, as you read from my quote, they're interested in righteousness. They're interested in control. We have a social contract between men and women that was established over the course of thousands of years that is dependent on women not having control over their fertility. That is the basis for the role differences that have evolved between men and women. And religion codifies those roles. So contraception is tremendously threatening to a conservative, meaning traditional, long-standing order, and in order, and religion is kind of a guardian of tradition it's change resistant. If you look at personhood, this idea of personhood from a secular standpoint, personhood isn't about something like an egg and a sperm coming together and then suddenly there's a soul. That is a religious concept. Personhood from a secular standpoint is dependent on consciousness, on sentience, the ability to feel, to experience pleasure or pain, to have preferences and intentions. And that is something that over the course of our history, we've become more and more thoughtful about. Originally, the rights and privileges of personhood were accorded largely at the beginning of this country, for example. Even though we had these great ideals, they were accorded largely to white males, landed white males. And we have had a conversation with each other over the course of 200 years saying, who counts? And we've struggled with questions of whether blacks were fully persons, whether poor laborers were fully persons. Does their experience count? Does their suffering and joy count? Are women fully persons? And that is a very different trajectory than the trajectory that would give personhood to a fertilized embryo.
Now, one thing I was thinking of with, when you're thinking about consciousness and pain and pleasure, I believe it's the majority of abortions in the U.S. take place 14 weeks or earlier. And as best we can tell with medical science, those are not 14 weeks and younger is not a period of time in which a zygote has feelings and can experience pleasure and pain. And so, if abortion has to happen, the earlier the better. And so all of these amendments, personhood amendments, ultrasound requirements, waiting periods, extra doctor's orders, all of those things delay abortion. If it's going to happen, it's best to let it happen earlier and more painlessly.
The irony is that nature or God, depending on what you believe in, actually aborts over 50% of fertilized eggs. They self-abort. And so there's a large natural practice of eggs discarded, simply getting discarded once they've been fertilized. Our bodies don't implant many of them, and then some of them get rejected afterwards. So it's a peculiar conversation, this conversation that we are having about personhood.
And I think the shifting that the perspective on the conversation of personhood to include the reality that we've had this ongoing conversation about this is a tremendously enriching perspective to take. It's not simply about birth. It's not simply about pregnancy. It's not simply about a baby, whether he breathes or she breathes, or whether he feels something or laughs or is able to cogitate. It's really an ongoing conversation about who we accept in our society, who we value, and to really see the long-term sort of discussion that we've been having across cultures and across different sort of defining aspects is I think a very enriching perspective to take on this conversation. We are Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480, and you may call in today. We are talking today about religious freedoms, about reproductive rights with Valerie Tirico, and I'm Rebecca Friedman, and with me also is Deanna Joy Lyons. We'll talk to you after the break.
Sigmund Freud said, "The voice of the intellect is a soft one, but it does not rest until it has gained a hearing." Whether you're at a point in life where you are questioning your beliefs, or if you've always been an atheist or agnostic, the Auburn Freethought Society is a place where your own voice of intellect will be heard. You'll interact with like-minded people, engage in intellectual conversation, and share your experiences with others in the Auburn, Washington area. At Auburn Freethought Society, we encourage critical thought and reason. For details, find us on Facebook and on Meetup.com. Auburn Freethought Society. Have real discussion and share real ideas. Really.
Did you know that not a single psychic or paranormal event has ever been reproduced?
Have you ever wondered about the effectiveness of faith healing, Reiki, or sports bracelets?
Was 9/11 an inside job, or is that all just another unproven conspiracy theory?
Come check out the Seattle Skeptics, a group focused on lively debates and a critical examination of pseudoscience, alternative medicine, and anything else that hasn't held up to the light of the scientific method.
Seattle Skeptics was created for those who require a higher bar of evidence than gut feelings or blind belief.
We're not contrarians or cynics, we just want to see the evidence.
And so should you.
Check us out at seattleskeptics.org.
That's seattleskeptics.org.
If you long to escape the religious bias on your television, if you love scientific shows, if you think that funny and thought-provoking are not mutually exclusive, then we'd like to welcome you to a network made with you in mind. Secular Video Network is an online source for free thinking programs. We feature a range of videos from Mr. D.D., The Thinking Atheist, and Richard Dawkins. While watching, you can participate in our live chat for engaging discussions. There is no cost, there is no proselytizing, just nonstop thought-provoking shows. So visit us at secularvideonetwork.com.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communications succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Come to this year's Northwest Freethought Alliance Conference, March 30th through April 1st at Renton Technical College in Renton, Washington. Speakers include Richard Dawkins, Oxford Professor Emeritus of Biology, and friend of the show Sean Faircloth, author of Attack of the Theocrats. In addition to this keynote address at the conference, Mr. Dawkins will be repeating his comments for the general public Sunday afternoon. Register for the full conference at nwfreethought.org or reserve your $5 ticket for the Sunday afternoon program at the same website by clicking on the second session added link. Go to nwfreethought.org and register today.
Join us after today's show at the Office Bar and Grill in downtown Tacoma. Offering a wide selection of tap and bottled beer, a full bar of your favorite liquor, and a taste bud tantalizing menu, come on down and shoot the breeze with the Ask an Atheist crew. Who can argue with your motives? After all, you're at the office. The Office Bar and Grill is at 813 Pacific Avenue in Tacoma.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. You can call us and ask us questions because that's what we're all about. 253-584-1480. I'm Deanna Joy Lyons, and with me today, Rebecca Friedman and Valerie Tirico. So we had a question that we wanted to discuss, and I think, Valerie, this is a bit in your ballpark as a psychologist. Blake from the Internet asked us, are theists stupid? Do you find that they are generally ignorant and lack critical thinking skills? Or is it some anomaly where they neglect to apply critical thinking to their beliefs? And what specifically can I personally do that would benefit the atheist movement, aside from donating money? First of all, send more money, always. What do you think, Valerie? Are theists stupid?
Well, you know, so the example that everyone cites is Francis Collins, you know, kind of from the Human Genome Project and at the National Institutes of Science, right? Who is an evangelical Christian. The reality is that religious belief tends to be inversely correlated with education, and there aren't a lot of elite scientists who are who believe in a person God. Those who do believe tend to believe in more kind of abstract versions of God and are more open to questioning the absolutists who insist the Bible is a literally perfect word of God and things like that, for example. But the reality is that we humans have an incredible capacity to compartmentalize knowledge and questions and to kind of hold one thought in one part of our brains and hold a completely incompatible kind of belief or, you know, thought in another part of our brains and keep the two from bumping up against each other.
I think that one thing that Blake's question sort of belies is that, you know, speaking of theists as possibly lacking critical thinking skills, not all atheists are champions of critical thinking themselves. Many atheists arrive at their atheism through applying skeptical principles and a scientific method and to sort of their worldview and questioning and through inquiry. But not all atheists arrive at atheism through that. Some of them are become atheists because they absolutely reject a sort of religion that they believe traumatized or stunted them in some way. Some atheists are merely not exposed to any kind of religion through their families or their schooling, or not exposed in a significantly indoctrinating way. And so I don't know that that it's necessarily fair to say that theists, you know, may not lack critical thinking skills, whereas atheists are champions of critical thinking. You know, there are some funny atheists out there that believe some funny things.
Absolutely.
But they may not believe in God, but they may believe in some very funny things that maybe they wouldn't believe in if they applied some critical thinking to them.
Yeah, there's a couple of different sort of, I guess you would call them, sects of atheism. You know, there's kind of the scientific and skeptical wing, which is sort of the largest and one of the most vocal of the atheism community, people like Richard Dawkins, who speak strictly on scientific terms, but they also approach God claims. But there are also a lot of atheists that I've, you know, seen online or read their blogs or spoken with that believe things, you know, like conspiracy theories or Bigfoot or UFOs. And you know, they don't see any conflict between those two, because to them, religion is obviously made up stuff. But, you know, cryptozoology has to be right. So it's always very interesting.
You know, I received an email this morning from an ex-minister who's an anti-theist now, an old retired guy in Illinois. And he, in the email this morning, you know, he repeated the allegation that the reason Sandra Fluck wanted contraception was because she was having so much sex. And I thought, do you think about these things that you forward at all you forward them?
And this woman, of course, that we're speaking of is the woman who wanted to testify before Congress or before the Senate on contraceptive accessibility and coverage, right?
That's right. But this person, I'm on several mailing lists, in fact, from people who I sometimes think of as having limited frontal lobe, who basically forward things that are incredibly easily debunked just by going to a site like Snopes or Truth or Fiction. And if you are paying attention, you can notice over time that that a lot of the things that just seem a little too good to be true, a little too dramatic to be true, a little too infuriating to be true, in fact, usually are a little too good or a little too dramatic or too infuriating to be true. But these are people who manage to kind of throw off what they now think of as a cloak of superstition that was fundamentalist Christianity, and yet they are completely uncritical about the other stuff.
So to sum it up, Blake, is it some anomaly where theists neglect to apply critical thinking to their beliefs? I don't know that it's necessarily an anomaly. I think it's probably an errant habit that we humans have, where we, as you said, Valerie, sort of compartmentalize our information and our thinking. And, you know, some things we apply critical thinking skills to and some things we don't. And I'm not sure that it's limited to theists, and I actually don't think it's much of an anomaly.
None of us are as rational as we like to think we are.
Absolutely. But, you know, sometimes you can sort of cultivate that happy sense of being wrong. When you discover something that you were wrong about, you can kind of encourage yourself and say, oh my God, I was totally, totally wrong about this. And it feels great because I know that now I can be more right than I was before. And it's an improvement. But we humans have a really hard time kind of admitting when we're wrong. We go, well, no, I wasn't wrong. I just was told wrong by that other person. Or, you know, we bristle at the idea, and it's kind of embarrassing to admit that you were not right about something. But, you know, a lot of us scientific skepticism flavored atheists try, by being aware of our own frailties, we can kind of cultivate that sense of always trying to correct and trying to update our information.
You know, my favorite description of the scientific method is, the scientific method is what we know about how not to fool ourselves. Because all of us are prone to what's called confirmatory bias or confirmatory thinking. We tend to filter and to look for information that confirms what we already think is true or what we want to be true. Rarely we kind of filter and look for information that confirms what we most fear to be true. But basically, the reason that the scientific method has made the difference between the Middle Ages and now is that it creates obstacles that obstruct confirmatory thinking. It forces people to ask the questions that could show them wrong, because we are all bad at that.
Kind of like peer review, you know, a scientific finding can't be published unless it's been criticized, and really sometimes very harshly criticized by the peers that know something about that. And, you know, there's something I was thinking I would like to talk about is, you wrote this fabulous article recently about a lot of the myths around contraception, things that, like, people believe that Plan B causes abortions, or, you know, that birth control pills can do the same thing. I was wondering if you might run through a couple of those. Can you tell us why it is that Plan B does not cause abortions and why people may think that it does?
Plan B contains a progestin called levonorgestrel. I still have trouble saying that. And the only kind of confirmed effect of that progestin is that it stops or delays ovulation. So it's happening, it's affecting before fertilization occurs. If there's no egg, then there's no fertilization, then there's no abortion. The reality is that there are people who are invested in and who are so obsessed with this kind of culture war that's going on, and who are invested in keeping women from having access to methods of contraception. They don't want women to have control over their fertility. It's threatening, as I said, to a kind of whole structure of relationships between people. So there are three kinds of post-coital or emergency contraceptives in this country. One is Plan B, another is called Ella, and then the third, which may or may not kind of affect the implantation of a fertilized egg, is that you can go after you've had sex and are concerned about being pregnant, you can get a copper IUD put in, and it is even more effective than either of the other oral emergency contraceptives, 99% effective, in fact, and then provides ongoing contraception afterwards.
And that's because the copper creates a hostile environment for the sperm primarily, right?
The primary mechanism, it's not, you know, there are things we don't understand completely about our bodies, but the primary mechanism of the copper IUD is that it interferes with sperm motility. So it's keeping the sperm from being able to reach an egg. It's different from oral contraceptives or from a hormonal IUD, the Mirena, which interfere with ovulation. And the hormonal IUD also creates a barrier at the entrance to the uterus that keeps sperm from being able to reach the egg.
So, Valerie, do you think that there's a sort of campaign to spread deliberate misinformation, or dare I say lies, about the mechanism behind all of these methods of birth control and controlling one's fertility? Or do you think that this is people falling victim to sort of these critical thinking fallacies, you know, or lack of critical thinking skills, or falling victim to our confirmation bias tendencies?
To be honest, I think it's a combination. I think that there are people in positions of power to communicate, who have been had it explained repeatedly that Plan B does not prevent, that if it doesn't cause an abortion, that if you've got an implanted egg, it doesn't do anything, in fact, much to the regret of some people. And they just simply don't want to hear it. I think there are other people who have become so obsessed with the notion that the loss of any fertilized egg is bad, that no matter what you say to them about what we know about how these drugs work, they keep saying, well, what if, what if, what if, what if? So they're kind of obsessed with the thing that they are afraid of. And it is that confirmatory bias that we talked about earlier.
Now, also earlier, before the break, we had talked about how the discussion may be about, you know, stop abortions, and we have to preserve all fertilized eggs at all costs, but that in your view, abortion is not really what's most interesting. Abortion is not the primary issue. It's more sort of a global sort of perspective on righteousness and purity. Can you speak about how that might sort of interact with those who don't abide by their form of religious purity, or may not be within that world? Sort of how does that affect us? What can we do about it?
Well, you have to remember that the rules that govern male-female relationships, for example, in the Bible and in kind of texts of that age, are basically based, women's rules governing the behavior of women are based more on property laws than on civil rights laws. The Ten Commandments say don't cover your neighbor's manservant or maidservant or ox or your wife, you know, basically anything that belongs to your neighbor. So the whole kind of structure was around men being able to have control over women so that they could have control over reproduction and they could know whose offspring they were investing their energy in. And then the structure of religion that has layered in on top of that, it has all kinds of precepts, teachings, patterns, habits, traditions that reinforce that notion of male control over females. So when you start talking about women being able to prevent or terminate a pregnancy, there's a whole massive edifice that is being called into question, that's being threatened.
Completely destabilizing, then, the whole structure, the whole hierarchy, and the whole tradition. Now, we do have, in our midst and amongst our friends and amongst your members on Wisdom Commons, religious progressives or religious moderates who may not feel the same way about fertility control and birth control. We had talked about how Catholics, the majority of Catholics themselves, at some point use birth control, use some kind of family planning methods, and that's in within one religion that is possibly the most strident about the sinfulness of condoms and of birth control. Do you think that this is an issue that non-religious individuals can take up with religious moderates and progressives? And sort of how do you foresee us sort of working together if you do?
Absolutely. There are many Christians who perceive the Bible, for example, as a record of our ancestors struggling to understand what is good and what is God and how to live in community with each other. And those people look to the Bible not by doing proof texting and taking things out of context, but instead trying to look at what is the trajectory of Scripture and what are the kind of core values of love and truth that are kind of reflected there. And so they may see their obligations, including their obligations around family planning, very differently.
Oh, there was something that you mentioned about the birth control pill, and I was wondering if you could rather quickly give us kind of the lowdown, and that when the birth control pill was developed, that the Catholic Church, or maybe the just other churches in general, had a problem with the concept of the birth control pill, and that women having their menstrual periods as part of the cycle was kind of a way to appease that sort of thing by, you know, allowing that that righteous suffering.
One of the developers of the pill, John Rock, was a devout Catholic who really hoped that the church would approve the pill as a form of natural family planning, as a kind of an extension of the rhythm method that simply extended the infertile period. And if you look at the church struggle within the Catholic Church, the history that that has been documented is that the church came close to approving contraception during the 1960s. There was a panel put together by the Pope who that made that recommendation, and they came close to approve the pill for other medical kinds of purposes. But what we're seeing at this point is kind of a backlash, I think, of you've got, I mean, frankly, we saw that panel of old white men who were up there saying women don't have anything to say, not only about women's health, women don't have anything to say about conscience or about religious freedom. And I think they are very threatened by the fact that they are losing a grip on their own membership as well as their ability to recruit new adherents. And they're in a battle to the death.
Well, Valerie, we're coming up at the top of the hour, and Deanna and I want to thank you so much for joining us today in the studio. You've been listening to Ask an Atheist. Valerie, we can find, I believe, a complete set of your writings at awaypoint.wordpress.com. You have a book. Your book is called Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light, and that's available on Amazon.com. You can read more about Valerie at valerietirico.com and catch her videos on YouTube, the Trusting Doubt channel, which is called
Life After Christianity.
Life After Christianity. Ask an Atheist is an NEDM production. We will be meeting at the office after our show. We've been Deanna Joy Lyons, Rebecca Friedman, Valerie Tirico. Our music's by Chris Coleman. Our production assistants today were Darren Garvin, Sam Mulvey, and Mike Gillis. See us at askanatheist.tv. Email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. And leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. We'll see you next week.
Clay Radio, your conversation station.